Welcome to the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast.
Everyone, it's the Oxley Bond MotoGP podcast back again, and we've got a very big subject to talk about this week. It's concussion, which is just a part of motorcycle racing. People fall off their motorbikes and they hit their heads, and they can get concussed even if they don't hit their heads. So as always, we like to talk to the experts. So first of all, we're going to talk with retired neurosurgeon Dr. Peter Richards, who worked in MotoGP in the 1990s as medical director. And after Peter, we're going to go to talk with Richard Harfoot, who works for body armor manufacturers D3O, who are working on anti-concussion helmet liners. Why are we talking about concussion? Well, because more and more is being learned about it and the effects of it. I mean, for example, not that long ago, a few years ago, a group of American footballers sued the NFL in a concussion lawsuit, which was settled for around $1 billion. Basically, these players claimed the NFL was negligent and in concealing the sort of findings about concussion. These include the big thing we're going to talk about. It's a bit of a mouthful. Luckily, there's we can get it down to three letters. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, known as CTE. So I'm just going to say CTE from now on because I only just managed to do that the first time. So, you know, brain damage, multiple brain damage can call that or cause that, or it can cause Parkinson's disease or early dementia. You know, get headaches, blurred vision, memory loss, insomnia, dementia, mood swings. So, you know, motorcycle racing is dangerous. We all know that. Racers accept the risk. When I raced many years ago, I kind of lost count of the times that I woke up in ambulances going, Nino, Nino, Nino. And I'd ask the medics, where are we going? And if they said Norwich Hospital, I knew I'd crashed at Snetterton. And if they said Nottingham Hospital, I knew I'd crashed at Donington. So it's a big deal. It's something that racers have to deal with. So first of all, we're going to go to Dr. Peter. We're going to call him Dr. Peter to separate him from Peter Baum, my podcast partner. So, Dr. Peter, I mean, what is the situation in motorcycle racing with concussion protocol? Is it a big problem? Isn't it a big problem? Let us know your thoughts, please.
Well, there are no protocols, really. There's nothing other than the doctor there sort of looking at a guy and saying, right, are you sure you're all right? Is it a big problem? Well, it depends how you want to deal with the sport. You know, it's not like boxing or rugby or NFL where you can expect to get concussed. It's if there's an event that can cause concussion, like you fall off. Now, you can make the sport safe if you all agree to ride around at no more than 20 miles an hour, so, you know.
That's a great idea.
Oh, lovely. There we are.
We did a working party on boxing way back in the 80s, which I was sat on, and we agreed that the only way to make boxing safe was to let the guys get into the ring, shake hands, then get out again. Easy, but yeah. It's not good for the sport. Now, with motorcycle racing, you've got to decide, are you prepared to take the risk of the unexplained event? And of course, we don't know what speed that will actually occur at. I mean, poor old Michael Schumacher, he raced, you know, Formula One for years and was all right.
Yeah.
Then he fell over skiing and bumped his head, and we've not seen him since. So it can occur at low speeds. Now, the problem with the CTE is it a number of impacts accumulated over the years, or is it one, you know, not severe enough to, you know, have you in an ambulance going Nino, Nino, but, you know, affect you? We don't know. We don't know what the thresholds are for injury. You know, do we decide that someone like Marc Marquez, who's fallen off a lot last season due to the Honda being rubbish, you know, has he accumulated a small number of injuries every time he falls off? Or is he just, you know, waiting for the one that will cause him problems? We've no idea. Now, the impact monitors in helmets, they're particularly good at picking up the very severe, the damaging ones. But they're not so good with picking up the minor ones because we don't know what the impact thresholds are. So
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite a big.
So although I said everything, a lot's known about it in motorcycle racing. It's like you know, in the NFL and boxing and so on. We know about it because you know the term punch drunk comes from boxers who are basically permanently punch drunk from repeated concussions. But you know, I've never known a punch drunk motorbike racer.
Yeah,
I've known lots of drunk motorcycle racers, but I've never known a punch drunk motorcycle racer apart from immediately after they're concussed. But you know, I've never known in my nearly 50 years in the sport anyone who seemed to kind of carry a kind of permanent injury, if you like, from repeated concussions. But you've got a very good the interesting thing, of course, that I think a lot of people don't understand is that you don't have to land on your head to be concussed, because if you land on your ass, your brain stops at the same speed as your ass stops when it hits the tarmac. You know, you've got a good Barry Sheen joke about that, I think, Dr. Peter.
Barry said after it was his Daytona crash, what goes through your mind as you're crashing at those speeds? And he said, my ass.
Good old Bazza.
Well, in a way, this is part of the problem. You should more or less as an organization not expect the racers to make clever decisions when it's about safety like this. That's why Barry was making jokes about it, because making jokes about it is the best way to stay away from the reality. The reality which later when you look back, I was like, wow, I've been very lucky there and I've been lucky there. I know a couple of stories for myself that I was now with what I know now. Very, very lucky. I had concussions. I had some.
Are you sure?
So I'm so lucky. I don't have any long-term problems other than, but maybe not everybody agrees, but I think so. Yeah. So that's the first thing I see. First of all, don't let it the rider make these types of decisions. But Dr. Peter, you told us, me as a technician, find that fascinating when you say we basically don't have a watertight system. You know, we can say for more or less for sure if we do a test after a big one, that's a concussion. But we don't know, you had already 9 and maybe after 10 you're in trouble. Is that a correct summarization of what you just said?
Well, that's about what we know. I mean, one of the problems is most of the knowledge that has come about CTE has come from post-mortem specimens, which is fine. It's about the air crash investigator wandering around the wreckage.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you much about what happens in real time. You know, they always want the black boxes because that tells them what happens in real time. We, at the moment, don't have a black box.
Wow. Yeah, I think Peter... No, you go on, Peter, because you know about this.
Yeah, the conclusions are not new. And in your time in the GPs, when you were there, for sure you had some rule of thumb, I think maybe you call it in English, some way of checking that rider, because riders always want to get back off the bike. You know, it's really like Monty Python. It's only a scar, you know, they always want to get back on the bike.
Yeah,
so,
I mean...
You for sure at that time had already some testing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's basically how does the person interact? Do they remember where they are? Do they know what circuit it is? Do they know which way it goes? You know, what country are you in? What time of day is it? It's relatively crude. Now, the psychologist will do deeper and deeper measurements if they've got time. You know, the rugby guys, you know, to do the full post-traumatic test is about 10 minutes. So they come off the pitch for 10 minutes, substitute comes on, they're put through a series of do this, you know, do tests, blah, blah, blah. And then they're either said, no, that's not good enough, you're out, or yes, you can go back on. But of course, even the ones where they're allowed to go back on, we don't know how much damage has been done.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're talking about players, you know, and riders getting concussed. I remember speaking to Kevin Schwantz a few years back, and he had a huge crash at Donington during practice for I think it was this, you know, when they used to have 1 hour practice sessions. There was no 15 minute, you know. So the last session, you know, you start off and then towards the end of the session, you put in your qualifying lap, and he crashed in the early stages. Got a lift back to the garage, and I think the Suzuki team was in the back. They had a kind of weird pit lane at Donington for a time when some of the pits were not facing the pit lane. It had a ride around the back of the pits and onto pit lane. And Schwantz was, he was heavily concussed and sort of sat down and sort of had a rest and said, just give me 10 minutes, you know. And Stuart Shenton, his crew chief, eventually said to him, mate, you know, you've got to go out because we've only got 10 minutes left or whatever. So Schwantz, and he literally didn't really know where, he couldn't remember which way the track went. So he said, just put the bike out on pit lane and I'll get on it and off I'll go. So he didn't have to ride out and turn left or right. He knew which way to go. So he went out, you know, obviously heavily concussed and got put in the third fastest lap at the qualifying session or something. So, you know, it's such a weird thing, isn't it? So he was obviously concussed, and yet it had no effect on his kind of ability to ride a motorcycle at insane speed. So it's such a strange thing. But then we see things that are really obvious now that shouldn't happen. You know, like you say, it's very difficult to understand whether somebody is or concussed or not. But when Diego Moreira, he crashed on the sighting lap of the Moto3 race at Phillip Island last year, and he was sort of wobbling through the gravel trap after crashing, and you could see that he was concussed, and even the commentators were talking about it. Wow, he looks like he's had a knock on the head, and he was allowed to race. You know, they got back to the repaired his bike, and he started the race, and he retired after four laps feeling dizzy.
Yeah.
Now, if the medical officers are not jumping on things like that, then there is something wrong. Of course, people are going to get, you know, if the crash wasn't seen, if he wasn't seen staggering through the gravel, then no one would have known. But the fact was, he was, and no one did anything. That kind of worries me. You know, I know motorbike racing is dangerous, and you break bones and you get concussed, and we don't really care. You know, you just get on with it because that's what you want to do. But when I see something like that happen, I go like, whoa, you know, that isn't right.
Yeah, but the problem is, for the medical people, you know, they'll say to the team, you know, I think he was concussed, and I think we haven't really got the detailed knowledge, and they'll say, okay, so our multi-million pound rider is not allowed to ride in this race. And what about the crowds? You know, I had this pressure when I was doing it. You know, it's...
There you go.
It's one of the problems.
But Peter, there is really, at the moment, there is... I heard a little bit about... I'm not too sure about the details, but I know there is some talks of some test that comes down to we do something outside the season when everybody is really healthy. We do a couple of tests with you. And when we suspect you hit your head a bit hard, we do the same test again. You can only be that far away from these. And that's already something that I don't really trust as an engineer. But do you know about this? And do you know they use this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, we don't use it. But I mean, it's what we have in boxing. You know, we have baseline psychology tests.
Ah, yeah. That's what it is, yeah.
And then later psychology tests, but, you know, they've got to have the psychologist to do it. They take a bit of time. And, you know, in the has he been concussed scenario at a race, it's not really practical. I mean, they are developing blood tests to say whether you have a concussion. But again, it's a blood test. It'll need analyzing and that kind of thing. There's nothing that you can do, literally snap your fingers, get an answer.
Apart from kind of a bit like a kind of, you do the sort of police test to see whether you're drunk, can't you? Walk in a straight line, put your finger against your nose. And the one I never get is recite the alphabet backwards. I mean, who the fuck can do that even if they're sober? But anyway.
Yeah. But
maybe only when I'm
right.
Only,
yeah.
But there isn't the breathalyzer test, which there is for drunkenness. What we need, really, I suppose, is a breathalyzer test that will say whether you're concussed or not. But it's not there. And then again, we've got to work out what are the thresholds. How concussed do you have to be?
What surprises me also is that the lack of advancement. Because when I was young and pretty sure I was going to be a world champion motocross, I obviously never became that, and I wasn't that talented, but also was not scared. What I know is they brought me home with the ambulance because I didn't really remember where I was, and they told me already at that time, okay, when you have one, be careful, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, I wasn't careful, so 2 weeks later, they had to bring me again. But already the know-how of having another one is dangerous and it's easier was already there. Now, the second memory I have of an ambulance was not that long ago. Anyway, that I was, and I want to share this with you because it's weird. When you say, you ask a guy, what is the date? What is your birthday? What is the month? These are silly questions, you know? So I failed. But the way I failed impressed me more than the fact I failed, because when the doctor asked me, so Peter, so what's your birthday? And I'm like, what a silly question. You know, it's like, yeah, for sure. I walk to the door, I open it. But suddenly the door was gone. Yeah. So while I was still giggling, like, what a silly question, I couldn't find it. And I'm, whoa. That was a bit of a shocker. So yeah, obviously I've been lucky. I had a couple of them, but I'm still here and at least good enough to do this. Mark Marquez, on the other hand, has, with this information now, been very, very lucky. I was fighting in the team in a rider against him for the world championship. And we only won it because he concussed himself so hard. Yeah. That you couldn't even see anymore. You know, that's not just a concussion. Yeah. That was a big, big one. And later, he had more of the same. Every time he crashed his head big time. His eyes started to look like left and right, you know? So that's the thing that he already has in him.
Dr. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong. It isn't a neurological thing. It's an eye muscle thing. I think it's one of his eye muscles that's obviously damaged, which is what they fixed when he first did it in 2011. They actually did an operation to go in there and do something to one of the optical nerves. I think it was the optical muscle. I'm pretty sure. So correct me if I'm wrong. That's not strictly neurological.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a bunch of muscles around your eye.
Ah, good.
And if one of them is damaged, yes, it can lead to double vision. Or you've got the nerve that controls it all.
Yeah.
And if that's damaged, it'll lead to double vision or the brain itself. But, you know, obviously that injury he had was at the more severe end, not so severe as to render him unconscious, but to affect him quite markedly. But I think the ones we're talking about here are the ones that don't necessarily cause such severe effects, but they may cause marked effects. I mean, in boxing, for example, if you're knocked out, you're not allowed to spar even for 28 days, let alone fight again. Whereas, you know, what about bike races? It's hard to say. And of course, we've got to bear in mind that if we're introducing these level restrictions for the top riders, you've got to come down the pyramid as well. And even, you know, your Wednesday afternoon tester at Brands Hatch, it applies to them as well.
Sure. We're kind of going into a bit how weird the brain is, like Peter, non-Dr. Peter, saying, you know, but he not being able to remember his birthday. Once I was knocked out at Donington and going through that fast left Starkey's Bridge, I crashed there, my 250 Wadden, and carted off to the hospital unconscious. And I only remembered what happened in the crash 6 months later. That kind of finally the memory, how weird is that, you know?
Yeah.
6 months later, I suddenly began to remember the thing had seized and it just shot me over the windscreen, you know, the thing just basically stopped in fifth gear and I went and I carried on, you know, and so that's just such a, I thought, wow, that is so weird I knew what had happened and it was in my brain somewhere and it had taken like 6 months to kind of work its way out to the front. Very odd, very odd.
But Peter, when you should be consulted, if Donna consulted you, which direction would you think to at least put something ready there?
It's very difficult to know. I mean, the pressures you have about, you know, the money, the, you know, the costs, etc., they're pushing you all the time. You know, I mean, Kevin Schwantz, you know, I knew quite well, and, you know, a number of times I kind of said to him, you know, when he dislocated his hip and said you should rest this for a number of weeks, you know, there's no question that
You know. So we're talking about two sides of the thing. First, you have the protection, you know, with the helmets. That's another story. All the materials, but the other side of the spectrum is also that people should be some sort of a way, in my opinion, to test riders, just because the situation they are in makes it highly likely they make wrong decisions. That's the best I can put it.
I also think the number of times they're expected to race is too high.
I'd agree.
There you go.
They should have a few weeks off, but they're not allowed it.
Yeah. Well, it all comes down to money again, doesn't it? Peter, non-Dr. Peter, you know a bit about the G-force sensors they have in Formula One helmets, don't you? And the whole post-crash scenario in F1. Can you tell us a little bit about what they do there?
Not a lot, but what I picked up is that just like boxers, the Formula One drivers have G-sensors, I think, in their ear mounted, which is a very accurate place because that's so close to your skull that these G-forces that are measured there are the real G-forces that acted on your skull. And like Clever Peter also said, it's not just the main impact, but when you put sensors there, me as a technician, I start to think ahead. You don't just read the spike and say, oh, that's not a very high spike, let's go on. You can also look back after a couple of laps, a couple of races, a couple of seasons and say, hey, that rider had, you know, spike level, whatever the number of G's you put on it, say 70% of what you think is the limit, but he had it many, many times. times. So maybe it is time, you know, once you have these sensors, they cost nothing for looking at the whole circus, what we are doing, the millions we spend. These sensors should be quite easy to implement. We have at the moment the whole bike full of sensors that are by radio frequency all the time monitored in race control. So you don't even need to wait till after the race to download it. Like in Formula One, they have these sensors plus oxygen sensors in the gloves from the riders, for an example. When there is a big crash in Formula One and the rider, the doctors going there with the car, they already see on the tablet what is the oxygen level in his blood, how much was the impact that he had, at least on his helmet, and so on and so on. So a couple of years ago, this was rocket science, and we call it Formula One for many reasons. Not the race series is called because it's the pinnacle of technology. But that at the moment is not that difficult or expensive or hard anymore. So I'm sort of, but like Clever Peter already said, once you start to do these things, it has consequences. Then you suddenly, when you measure something, you have to do something with it. Somebody is responsible. Somebody can be sued. And other levels of racing where kids from rich parents are maybe just starting to race and something happened, before you know it, you can open a can of worms there. I think that's how Dorna looks at it. It's a can of worms. Yeah. Let's don't open it. But society moves on. We don't accept the same risks as we did 15 years ago, 10 years ago anymore in many other sports as well. So maybe motorsport should catch up here a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Sports are evolving. I mean, boxing was at the head of all this quite a bit of time ago. And now it's then rugby. Obviously. And now it's gone to soccer heading the ball. The pinnacle of motorsport, yes. But what about the lower levels? No.
Exactly.
When will motorcycle racing catch up? Can it ever? As I say, 20 miles an hour, nobody gets hurt, or very, very rarely.
And nobody wants.
No, that's not racing.
It's a tricky one. No. I'd say a million things in defense of motorcycle racing. But one thing in this area is, like I said, I've known hundreds, probably thousands of motorbike racers, and I've never known a punch drunk motorcycle racer, even though this is quite a common thing in boxing and so on, isn't it? So that kind of gives me hope in a way. You know what I mean? That you're not seeing riders retire and then in their 30s or 40s like being drunk all the time, basically, because they're slurring their speech and they've already got dementia. And so I've never known anyone like that, so that makes me feel good.
But there might be people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and as you say, maybe it's because they drank too much. We don't know.
What are you suggesting, Dr. Peter? How dare you? I mean, I've kind of dedicated my whole life to trying to destroy my body in all kinds of ways. I'm not sure. I don't think I've got CTE, but who knows? Some people would probably, my wife would probably say I have. anything else you want to say, Dr. Peter?
When's your birthday?
3rd of March.
What date's your birthday?
I can't remember.
What a silly question. Maybe check it out. Yeah. It was such a weird experience. It's such a weird experience to simultaneously think, what a silly question. But it's really like, how can I not know? It's like a couple of weeks ago, I was in the hospital. They removed a couple of pins from my hip and they did it. But I don't know how you say it is in English, but when they give you the... that you can't feel your legs anymore, in the bottom of my back.
Epidural.
I had it a couple of times and it's always so weird because when you wake up, suddenly under the blanket, your hand feels there is something there. But there is no connection with my brain. So there's some meat laying there. But these are your legs. You can look at these legs and tell them to wiggle your toes, but nothing happens. And that's a weird feeling as well. And it was that weird when I couldn't find my birthday anymore, So that's a weird thing. One other thing that now, quickly changing the subject while I'm on the microphone. The other thing, if I think back a little bit about when I was trying to ride motorbikes fast in circles, breaking bones and coming back is like brave.
Yeah.
We all love that kind of stories. Concussions are not sexy. They're not brave. So it's easily neglected. It's almost, if anything, it's sexy to say, I really didn't know where I was, like we just did all the time, Matt and I, and then the next day be on a bike again. I mean, wow, that's a brave guy.
Or stupid.
Okay, now I'm 60 and I don't find it that brave anymore. And I really, really hope that my kids or whoever I know that never does that. I just hope for society and after that for motorcycle racing that we pay a little bit more attention to the concussion side of things. things. And my practically thinking, it's probably more likely that it comes from technology. Some of these sensors that you need to measure these, they are so incredibly cheap and easy to attain at the moment. I know in bike racing and data recording, 10, 15 years ago, we had some quite expensive accelero sensors to buy, and they were not even very reliable. And now they are in every phone from €150, and they are a lot better and smaller and faster and more accurate. So that stuff, that, why is not one helmet manufacturer already putting it inside the helmet? You know, with the SIM card on it or with a Bluetooth connection to your phone and an app on your phone, and you come back and you say, whoa, that was a bit of gusting wind shocks on my helmet, or not, or that crash was like this. You know, maybe we have to put our hopes in this direction, because it's relatively cheap to do by now, that type of sensors. That I know.
Oh, yeah, it'd be relatively easy to do, but it's the consequences you have to consider.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're talking about concussion not being sexy. You know, we all, you know. Yeah,
there we are back at Donna.
The old phrase, chicks dig scars and all that, and, you know, walking around with a broken arm like a hero and all that nonsense. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that, and I don't think I'm alone, you were probably the same, Peter. You know, the only things that scared me when I raced was, long-term brain injury or being in a wheelchair. Everything else, including death, didn't really,
was
completely acceptable. And I think that's the way you have to be with a racer. Yeah. You know, you have to acknowledge, if you don't acknowledge that the worst can happen, then you're an idiot. You know, I mean, it can happen, and it does. So you've got to acknowledge it. All right, Peter, if anything else to say, or smart Peter as opposed to double smart Peter has got something to say.
Well, I'm curious about some of, yeah, exactly, smart Peter. Can you tell us some of your stories from that time when helmets designs weren't really, really there? Was it maybe at that time, did you see sometimes a logic between the type of injuries and the quality of the gear that the guys were using? And did you try to say that a little bit left and right?
Well, at that stage, full face helmets were beginning to get lighter, and that's what you need.
Wow.
The lighter helmets, that they'll absorb impact, but they won't move your head around too much. I think there's a limit to what you can go, and we probably reached that now. I don't know, you're going to get a helmet guy talking shortly. It's more to do with the linings and how much energy they can absorb, etc. We were getting, beginning to get them lighter back then, which is good. But you can only have them so light, the shell and the lining. You know, you've got to come down to a certain level, and then it'll stop.
All right, Dr. Peter, that's been really fascinating, chat about a very complex subject, much more complex than I kind of thought it was, to be honest. and a perfect segue into our next chat with Richard Harfoot, who works for D3O, who are working on a anti-concussion helmet linings. And obviously, they're not the only people. There's quite a few people working in that direction now. So thanks a lot, Dr. Peter. And we'll now go over to Richard Harfoot. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Okay, that was a great chat with Dr. Peter Richards. And now we're going to go to Rich Harfoot, who's head of motorsport at D3O, which is the world's largest producer of body armor, I believe. They make body armor for all kinds of sports, basically when any kind of sports where people get hurt, from motorcycling to bicycling to ice hockey to et cetera, and they make stuff for all kinds of companies like Furigan. So Johan Zarco wears their stuff. Michael Dunlop wears their stuff. They're also used by Rucker, Bellstaff, VR46 gear. If you buy a VR46 jacket, it's got D3O body armor in it, and so on and so forth. So they make something like 500,000 back protectors every year, and several million limb protectors for knees, elbows, shoulders, hips, chests, knuckles and ankles, etc., etc., and also used a lot in the military. And so this is the kind of solution to the problem that we've already been talking about with Dr. Peter Richards. And Peter Bonn is now going to tell us, because Peter is a huge cyclist. You might already have worked that out in our pods. He loves cycling almost more than motorcycling, which is the same as a lot of people in the paddock, except, in fact, like Cal Crutchlow and, you know, everyone in the paddock loves cycling. They're all crazy for it. So you know, this sort of anti-concussion helmets are already bigger in cycling than in motorcycling, aren't they, Peter?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Matt. We, in the cycling helmets, they have this MIPS system, this MIPS thing already for years. I think I'm on my third already. It's
supposed to mean multi-directional impact protection system. And what it comes down to, and I like the idea. I'm not sure if it's as useful in mountain biking what I'm doing as it is with helmets that you crash with on the road. But what it does, it effectively creates like a little free play between the outer side of the helmet and the inner liner. The inner part of the helmet is really tied to your head. And what it does by allowing a couple of degrees sort of damped movement, it's not free. When you hit the ground for whatever, in my case, 30 kilometers per hour, and you hit the tarmac, the resistance between the helmet and the tarmac will try to quickly rotate the helmet with the speed that I touch the tarmac. Well, my head, if it can spin with that same speed shortly, it will damage my gray grease that's inside. That's a bit, you know, the brain, the part of the brain that's like not liquid, but I don't know how to say it in English. But anyway, if you rotate very, very quickly your skull, that's the damage done, more or less. And to prevent that, they have like a damper. Yeah, it's a damped movement between the outer skin and the part that's really tied to your head. And I found it a really good idea. It's not crazy expensive. It didn't make cycling helmets a lot more expensive. I would say 20-30%, but that's still silly money compared to motorbike helmets. So yeah, I'm keen on them. It's a bit funny the first time you use them, because you think you bought one that's too big. It feels tight around your head, but you touch it with your head, the outer skin, and you can move it a little bit. You just have to get used to that. But I was already wondering when and why you should come in motorbikes. Now, I know already that they are coming to motorbike helmets more and more. It's a thing we speak about more and more often, and it's something we have to get used to. I see the logic completely, but then that's just silly me from a distance. So I can't say anything in reality how far we are at the moment in motorbike helmets, Matt.
I think Rich will probably bring us up to speed. That's what we hope. So D3O are now working. I actually visited D3O a couple of months back and looked at all their gear and so on, and they sort of told us that they are kind of starting to work, or have started work on a kind of, let's say, anti-concussion helmet liner. Not a helmet, but the liner. That's right, isn't it, Rich?
That's correct, yeah. And also, thanks for the intro, Matt. That's you're spot on with all those points. So obviously, rotation aside, because obviously MIPS is, as you say, Peter, is specifically rotational in its design, and there's a number of other facets inside a helmet that can mitigate rotation, even down to the natural, like you say, the way that the skin moves on top of the skull. That's a natural, essentially a natural anti-rotational system that we're born with.
Yeah.
But creating safer motorcycle helmets is undoubtedly something that we need to be pursuing, and above and beyond the standards as well. I think that's key to what we're doing at the moment in D3O is we specialize in sort of reactive foams. So soft, we're talking polyurethanes, TPRs, TPEs. So we create materials that can essentially have energy management properties. That's what we do in Formula One. That's what we do in NASCAR. It's what we do with the military. It's what we do in commercial motorcycle apparel as well. So with that, we have to pass CE. And really, once you pass CE, job done. That's it. You got your tick. You can produce a product for manufacturing and sale.
Remind us what CE is, please.
So it's it's a worldwide, but mostly European legislation to ensure that a consumer is not getting a product that is going to harm them without due warning. So there'll be a CE mark on pretty much anything that comes out of a factory, whether it's a toy or a helmet or an iPhone. It's been tested that it won't cause you irreparable damage. And then we can go off on a sidetrack into things like Prop 65 in California and other materials that have specific sort of clampdowns on them. So just to get back with D3O, yes, what we're looking at is helmets. We've been working in helmet broadly for years, both in snow. We're looking at brands like Burton, Scott Sports. We are widely used in team sports in America, baseball, ice hockey. Helmets are not something new to us, but moving into the world of motorcycle helmets, when we're using the ECE 006, we have to look at essentially what is the EPS doing. That's passing the test. So in a helmet, you've got your polyprop outer shell that you put stickers on, you've got your EPS, and then you've got a bit of comfort liner inside that makes sure it's snug, it fits, it's absorbs moisture, and it creates a good fit on your head. That's all it does. So at the moment with Moto, what we're looking at is bringing out what we call our Halo liner ranges. Okay. We have these already in military. That's what the US Army have got them on their heads. Every single soldier has got our Halo system, which is the lightest and the best pad that the US military are buying. And also that's great for us because that they're not buying it because it's orange. They're not buying it because it's D3O. They've tested everything. They can afford anything. They buy our material because it's the best. And that's a great accolade that we like to, you know, remind people of. Moving into motorsport again, with these helmets, it's starting from scratch. So the helmets already pass ECE. They pass FIM. So these racers, you know, Marquez, Acosta, they can put on their helmet and know that they're passing. They're allowed on the grid. They're allowed to race. But do they really understand that really it's just the EPS around their head that's a 60-year-old, you know, refrigerator insulation material that hasn't changed much is the only thing that's protecting them when they come off at 200 miles an hour? And that's really where we are, is helmets have evolved, but they haven't been revolutionized yet. And I think if somebody can make an EPS that's as light and as cheap and as effective in a single impact, then they'd be a very happy camper. But really all we can do is tweak things. We can have multi-densities. So we can have a low density that will create a slightly more decelerative property to an impact. So if you look at the cockpit around a Formula One driver, you see that cockpit's very high. If they move their head left or right or back, it will hit what it looks like a bit of bodywork. But actually, it's a very soft, compressible foam, a low-density foam like EPS. And it's designed not to resist an impact, but to actually decelerate that head into the car. So it's that deceleration that, I know, Peter, you'd understand, that's what you need. A sudden stop is bad news. Deceleration, slowing, is what you need to try and do to help somebody's brain not get twisted and bruised and rubbing on their skull. So D3O are creating a low-energy impact liner to use in motorcycle helmets and cycling helmets. I can't tell you too much, obviously, with brands that are bringing these out, but hopefully it's going to bring a slice of the pie that consumers don't really know that they need yet. It's a bit like the airbag and seatbelt analogy. You know, the airbag goes off in your car when you've had a big one. The seatbelt will lock when you go over the potholes and minor movements, but they can still hurt. So, yeah, Peter, you raised your finger there.
Yeah, well, you said something interesting, the airbags. FIM never asked for airbags. It's the industry that created the airbag, and then FIM said, oh, that's cool. Let's make it compulsory for everybody. What can we expect from helmets improvements for safety if it was up to you?
I think it would be just a lot of foam. That'd be good for me. But I think what there needs to be is we can't create a helmet that is bigger. We can't create one that's heavier. We can't go down what you would do to fortify somebody. To make your head the safest, the helmet would be 10 times the size, 10 times the material. So when you did crash, your head wouldn't feel much. That's not realistic. So what we have to do is work within the parameters of a helmet that is big enough, but not so big that it creates problems with aero, vision, you know, weight on the neck, that sort of thing. So I would like to see a helmet where EPS has been improved, where we can have a helmet that's thinner and lighter. Straight away, that will reduce inertia in an accident. That will reduce stress on obviously on vertebrae and what have you during whiplash. So a lighter helmet through better, improved, compressible materials like EPS. But really, it's I think helmets will go down the road of advanced polyurethanes in the future. I think EPS will have its day. And we will find a foam that is the same weight and can actually absorb multiple impacts. As you know from being a biker, if you drop your helmet off the side of a table, you know you've dented the top of your brand new helmet. It's not safe anymore because if you crash on that point, it's already compressed. You're not going to get the same level of impact protection again. So how about a helmet that when you're tumbling down the road at the end of, you know, Misano Strait, you come off and you're ragdolling down the road and you hit your head at the same point of your helmet a few times, that material should be reacting, bouncing back and then taking another hit. Reacting, bouncing back, etc. So I'd like a helmet to be multi-impact and have a level or a broad range of impact performance. At the moment, we're only looking at what the EPS does. That's like you said, you know, the FIM, what passes the ECE or FIM test, it's that high level big hit. What about all the impacts underneath that, the subconcussive hits, all the small high sides, the low sides, the impacts that you wouldn't necessarily see EPS active? That's what's going to give the rider a headache because nothing stopped the energy coming from the road through to their brain. EPS has done nothing, polycarbonate's done nothing, the liner has done nothing. What is there? So the liner needs to be improved, step one. Let's get D3O in there and make sure that subconcussive energies are managed. And then in the future, if I could design my own helmet, yeah, it would have a vastly improved EPS system that was either EPS or TPU and multi-impact. And with my name on the back, obviously, and a copyright.
Rich, I'm stickler for details. So what does EPS stand for?
Good one. Expanded polystyrene. So exactly what, when you buy your fridge, that's what it comes wrapped in. It's the same stuff.
Okay, right. Yeah, no, exactly. Because obviously I've seen your, you know, the sort of raw materials that you make all your body armor out of, and obviously you've got chemists that are working on different types of plastics or rubbers or whatever you want to call them. Sorry for being non-technical. So do you think that you'd obviously presumably have to make a new type of, you know, come up with a new chemical mix for some, you know, for an anti-concussion helmet liner? It would be obviously different from a back protector or whatever.
Yes, so I think we've got hundreds of different grades of material. Everything that does for a knuckle, for a motorcycle glove, to a back protector, to some material inside an automotive tier one supplier, you know, material that's in a Formula One car. They're very, very different. They're doing very different jobs. To sort of condense it nicely, we specialize in impact, but we are here to look after and mitigate fatigue and vibration. Those are our three core focuses. We have quite a suite of materials that we can dip into.
And... Well, you said Formula One helmets there. Am I wrong in saying that both are helmets, but that's probably where the similarities end, because the situation in where they are used is so different. Bike riders, I don't need to explain you, they can fly everywhere and hit everything and from every angle and every position, and Formula One sits in his car and obviously he can have huge impact on it, but you can more or less see on what angle and level and from what pitch that it will come in. Is that a correct conclusion, or what am I missing?
Just to clarify, when I'm mentioning how our materials can become an energy management system, it's not necessarily just in helmets. So when I'm talking about Formula One, if you think broadly, I can't give you details, but everything from obviously the driver, but to the car, to the pit crew, to pit equipment, all sorts. So our material is there to be used where there's a gap in protection or in vibration or fatigue. So not necessarily helmets. So if you take Bell, for instance, as a prominent helmet manufacturer in Formula One, they will have a pretty good idea of, you know, within the standards, within a driving environment, what threats there are. So, yeah.
Sure. And I think when we visited you a couple of months ago, you were saying about half the Formula One teams use your stuff. And as you say, so it's from mechanics, knee pads, for example, to sort of, like you said, the sort of, again, I'm kind of call it rubber. I know it's not rubber, but, you know, around the cockpit to kind of, and to save the driver from vibration, because obviously F1 cars are very stiff. They've got bugger all suspension and, you know, so they vibrate like hell. So you're quite involved in that as well, aren't you?
Exactly. That's correct. I mean, again, I have to be careful what I say at this point, but quite rightly, around half the grid use D3O in a situation. Some very similarly, because obviously it's a small world, and they, you know, teams lose people and they move to other teams and they bring their knowledge and they adapt. And so I've been doing that for about 10 years now in Formula One, and it's been very interesting to see how some of the materials that they have been using, how crude they are, really, because like you say, the car itself is so incredibly stiff, but yet you're putting a gooey, soggy human in the middle of it to use, of course, in an accident situation, or just through driving those things and the g-forces they've got and the vibrations, there's not a lot going on to give those guys a break. So they need to concentrate, they need to be focused, they don't want to have irritations or, you know, blurred vision or, you know, losing blood to certain extremities, etc. So that's where we come in. So we keep it quite top secret, because obviously there's a lot of money involved and a lot of secrecy involved. But as a company, as a commercial brand, we use that to learn. So we take that and use that in our labs, in the way that we develop our products. So the back protector you're wearing on your bike that you can buy is all related to the research that we do and the feedback we get from things like Formula One. And we've also, just on that note, just moved into NASCAR and launched with NASCAR teams, a legacy motor club that we're proud to supply and be a partner of. And we're doing the same job there. We are within those vehicles, giving those guys, you know, 500 100 laps. We're giving them a break, and we're giving that, you know, that lots of different areas, either during accidents or through regular driving, racing, giving them a little sort of edge, as it were. So that's, yeah, lots of things that we can go down rabbit holes on, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, Richard, you mentioned that you would like to have a helmet that can absorb a couple of different impacts, or even impacts on the same area, a couple of them in a row, because you're tumbling down the Misano gravel trap you famously noted about. Where does that bring us with knowing that your gear is still fit, or you should replace it? Because, you know, old school was like, if the if the helmet's going to be not tight enough anymore, it's probably time to buy a new one. And if you had a biggie, depending on your budget, you buy a new one, or you say, nah, it wasn't that big, and you continue. So how do we know nowadays with your materials?
It's a very good question. So within the helmet, it's fundamentally you can't see what's going on under the polypropylene. So there are companies out there that have started doing scans, you know, so almost like an MRI of your helmet, and they can see where there's air pockets or there's been damage, what have you, which I think is a great idea. If you've got an expensive helmet, it's worth a few bob to get it checked over if you've had it off, if you don't want to replace it. But yeah, at the moment, we're still in the same place where if you're a normal rider and either you've had your helmet for too long and the liner has started to sag, the materials will degrade. You know, you shouldn't be, if you're wearing a helmet regularly and you're sweating or you're riding in the rain, or even leaving it on the, you know, on the coffee shop table while the sun's out for a while, you shouldn't be really using it for, I think 5 years is, 5 or 7 years, I think, is the advice.
Okay, Rich, and regarding the damping material, one of the helmet, let's say, engineers, technicians in the MotoGP paddock told me that the test to pass at the FIM is quite expensive. So at his manufacturer that he represented in the paddock, decided to only homologate, I call it, only one size, the M. Means if you're Alex Rins and you've got a lot of hair and maybe a big head too, you might end up, in my simple thinking, with less damping material between the outer shell and your head. Is that too short a conclusion, too simple, or am I sort of a little bit right?
No, well, I haven't heard of that, so I'm surprised if they've only adapted the FOM to one size of helmet. That doesn't make much sense to me. But there's political aspects to this as well. So I can't really speak any further on that. But I think it's a bit daft that you would insist that every rider on the grid is wearing the same size helmet. I don't see how that works.
I guess they can probably only sign riders with a certain size head. Sorry, mate. No, we'd love to give you a contract, but your head's too big or your head's too small. Yeah. Literally and metaphorically. Yeah.
Your head's too big.
So you really think, Rich, you really think you can help the concussion situation?
We do. I mean, we're already doing it in other sports. There are sports with very strict rules around headwear. So rugby, for instance, you know, rugby has a very strict rule. So we would like to be applied there in terms of skull caps. But there's a very old strict rule that cannot be at the moment changed. And our material falls outside of those parameters. But if you look at in the States, we have a number of different brands like Adidas that use soft skull caps with our material in for rugby, football, lacrosse, hockey, anything involving, you know, either a, you know, physical impact on your head from someone else or a ball, there are skull caps with D3O in there. So the concussive part is already out there. It's just when we come to moto and we come to cycling, mountain bike, that world of two wheel is a step on, because we've suddenly got these regulations that are incredibly strict. We've got the fact that now motorcycle helmet weight is so incredibly important. So if you look at a good high quality carbon helmet, whether it's AGV or another brand, we're looking around sort of 1200 grams. You don't have really much wheel room to add safety unless you start adding weight. And that's why at the moment there's only so much you can do to the current chassis of a helmet. At the moment we're just tweaking. We're polishing current helmet technology. We're not revolutionizing it yet. So with our liners, we're doing the best we can with the host that we have. So we're going into a helmet with EPS. What can we do here? And I don't think anyone's in the position yet to replace EPS, but we are in the position to look at the comfort liner and say, at the moment, all that liner is doing, these cheek pads, the skull cap, all it's doing is doing sweat management and fit. There's nothing else that it gives the ride. No impact protection, nothing. It's just fit to stop it wiggling around and having EPS touching your head and giving you a sore head. So we would like to improve that. So I think that's something that we can quite easily do. We're just commercially finding the best steps to get that on the market, because using it in the commercial world with helmets, nothing happens overnight. There's molds, there's tools, there's historical reasons. You have the strong influence from the Japanese brands that could be incredibly traditional in the way, obviously the Arrows of the world, and then some other brands coming up that are being a little bit more revolutionary in the way that helmets are constructed. And we need to fit into that broad spectrum of brands as well, because we're essentially D3O is we're a consumer product. We're an ingredient brand. So just like Brembo is to calipers for motorsport, we are for impact protection for apparel. So that's where we are.
I mean, Rich, you think the EPS could be like thinner, and then you could have a sort of thicker anti-concussion lining within, i.e. between the EPS and between the sweat lining?
Yeah, potentially. I think, but really EPS is the issue there, is that it will deform after an impact and it won't go back. So all the little air cavities inside the EPS will be crushed, and that's it. It's done. It's a one-use only product. And the other thing with those air cavities is it can let in moisture, dirt, all sorts that can break down the efficiency of it. So there are other brands out there making other crushable forms. But EPS is the only one that helmet brands can make in volume at a cost that pass the tests, that are light enough. And that's quite a lot of boxes to tick for any brand coming in wanting to try and replace it. So I would like to get EPS out in the future to have any revolution, I would say.
Right. I mean, how long before we see a D3O helmet liner?
Not long, hopefully. So would say that this year there'll be something that you'll be able to see. And again, it's something that we want to get.
So you're working with an existing manufacturer. You're obviously not going to tell us who.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's my role. I mean, you talked earlier. I'm very much on the commercial side rather than technical. I'll dabble in technical, but I'm not, as you'll probably have realized already, I'm not a professional on that side. I will look at how the market works, which brands are out there, how can we create relationships and grow our brand. That's my job essentially is to do that.
From a racing point of view, though, it's so important that somebody finds a way of kind of solving the concussion issue, because it is a huge issue in motorcycle racing. So we hope your product arrives quite soon, and we hope, and I guess there's others on the way as well, but I really hope that this kind of, because getting concussion A isn't very nice, and B it's kind of bad, it's A bad for the rider, and B it's bad for the sport, because you know, you get riders, you know, you have a superstar that gets concussed and he can't race the next week or whatever, and you know, that's, I mean, not good for anybody, you know. So
that's exactly it. No, it's the that's the same the same way we look at body armor as well with road racers like Mike Michael, or close circuit like Johan, or even when we were working with Sam Lowe some years ago. Sam was great as a crash tester because he loved the gravel. So we got a lot of data back. We got a lot of data back from him.
Wow, that's harsh.
And again, the difference, like you say, practice one, you come off and you take a tumble. The better your armor is, the better you can focus in a few hours' time when you get your new bike put together and you're back on track, rather than, you know, rolling around in pain. So the same for road race, short circuit. That's where we try and bring some benefit. So there's the concussive side in helmets, the same, obviously more important, more vital in terms of life-threatening, but still we have the same policy of trying to get people to stay on during their performance sport, whether it's motorbiking or what have you. And if they have had an off, it's getting back to doing it as quickly as possible afterwards.
I can imagine, Richard, your job is probably extra hard, especially to make sure, how do you say it in English, how to promote is not a good word. When you bring 10 horsepower, everybody wants to have it. When you bring better brake pads, everybody wants to have it. There is no price too high. But when you say, yeah, there's a liner in this helmet and it will probably help here and there, and they just want to have it as light as possible and as small as possible. So rule number one, don't listen to the riders. They don't know what they want. You know, they only when they get older, they start to look back and say, that wasn't too clever at the time. I wouldn't do that again. I would not suggest that to younger riders, but what do you do? Riders are getting younger every year. So
don't listen to the riders, but also be careful by listening to the FIM. They're also not really that advanced. So it's almost like you have to bring a really ready-to-go product that is 10 times better than everything else. And then maybe after some years, we will see something.
It's interesting. Yeah.
I'm afraid. But I wish you... Yeah, just my point of view. Huh?
It is, yeah. It's interesting because, again, nobody really wants to talk about the danger, because the riders want to focus on speed, lap times, focus. If they start thinking about how much their skull could be deformed in an accident, it's not, they don't want that in the back of their mind, you know, literally. So that's one thing, is that we need we need to keep that out. And that's our philosophy, is the subliminal benefit of D3O. The fact that you know that you're protected, but you're not going to feel it, and you can just get on and do your job. Back to your point about the riders, yeah, I think it's probably best that we go through the families and speak to the families and say, we've got something for you. I think your son or daughter needs to ride in.
Yeah, speak to the girlfriends, the girlfriend and the mum and dad, yeah. All right, Rich, it's been great having you on.
There you go.
It's been fantastic having you on, really interesting. You say you're not a technician, but I think a technician would probably blind us with too much science. So I think you've been...
Thanks,
perfect
sir.
In kind of explaining
a lot.
What hopefully can be done to solve this sort of elephant in the room of motorcycle racing. And we look forward to seeing your stuff on the track soon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Great. All right, Rich, many thanks.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Sam. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we will be back same time, same place next Sunday. All right, thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.